Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to the Big Change Podcast, where we are exploring how ordinary Christians can change their world. My name is Jonathan Wilson, and I'm your host. Joining me today is Alison Klein, who until recently played a lead role on the private equity side of FMO, which is a Dutch development bank. And Alison is now founder of Akmazo, an impact investing advisory firm. Welcome, Alison.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Alison, we'll hear a bit more of your background in a moment, but let's start with why it is that you're passionate about investing on this continent. What's motivating you? What's driving that?
I think my passion for Africa has evolved over time. So when I started investing there, actually when I started looking at investing there, it was purely as part of a commercial asset manager that looking at its emerging markets allocation saw sort of a white spot on the map. And so my first sort of look into investing in Africa was purely from the perspective of filling in a gap in the allocation. When I moved to FMO, then it was really with the intention to pursue impact investing. And so the passion at that time was like, here's a place where there's plenty of need for capital and where it's very concrete that this capital can be invested to have both financial return, but also to sort of contribute to making people's lives better and to sort of conserving our environments. And after working there for the past 12 years, I would say a big part of my passion about working in Africa is actually the people that I've gotten to know there and really feeling like these are cultures where I've really felt a sense of belonging in terms of individual people, but also in terms of cultural values. And so that's probably the most recent answer I would give to that question.
Yeah. And again, we'll come to your story more fully in a moment, but just to return to what we introduced to listeners in the first episode, this theme of reconciliation that we find throughout the New Testament, but in particular in the letter of Colossians, which is the kind of base text that we've been using for this series, that there's kind of four dimensions to reconciliation. The first is where we are rescued. We just need to be rescued first and foremost in order to be pulled out of our brokenness and brought into a relationship with God that opens up the possibility of transformation in all these other areas. And that leads to the reorientation of our minds. And out of that, we're in a position to start to engage in repair and reordering in our world. And so there's these four R's that we've been working with through this series so far, and we'll continue to work with. So we've been in a remote tribe, we've been in the political realm, and now in today's episode, we're moving firmly into the world of business and of capital. And Alison, this is the world that you and I work in. So before we go further, let's talk about you. You have now left FMO. You've started this company called Akmazo. And Akmazo is a Greek word that means to flourish, which is very central to what we're talking about, that God's work in our lives and our world results in flourishing. So, Alison, tell us a bit more about you, your life, your work, and why your company is called Akmazo.
Well, where to begin? Recently, I've been calling myself the reluctant entrepreneur. But I suppose if I start a bit earlier, I should call myself the accidental capitalist. I ended up working in private equity without having any family background really in business. My father was a seminary professor. My mom had been a high school English teacher. And after taking a few years off when my sister and I were small, got a PhD and became a college English professor. So there was no one sort of stimulating me to have a career in business or finance, nor did I have any idea what any of those things were. So at college, I studied psychology. It was really the most interesting major that they were offering. Then I got a job in market research. And from there, I basically proceeded with my career by trial and error, not really having a big picture goal in mind, until I finally landed in a venture capital firm. And then I thought, aha, this is the thing that really fits me. So I often tell people I got into the world of finance through the back door. But another way to look at it, of course, is that I received certain gifts, abilities, and opportunities. And whilst I was trying to make sense of it all, God kept drawing me more and more into the mindset of using those gifts for the greater good. So by the time I found my way into venture capital, I was also busy applying for business school. And I applied for a fellowship at the time from a foundation called the Mustard Seed Foundation, called the Harvey Fellowship. And my application for that actually was an inflection point in cementing my sense of calling in this area, because I had to write about why did I want to work in finance and how would that put me in a place that was relatively underpopulated with Christians. And I think we can come back to that, because certainly in the African context, there's a lot of people of faith in this industry. And as well, that I wanted to work with the tools of finance actually to help make the world a better place. And in those days, we didn't have the word impact investing yet. But in my mind, I was starting to formulate this sort of purpose that I would say has come to more and more characterize my work. That's about using the tools of finance, not only to create a financial return, but also to contribute to making the world a better place. And that can be for people and as well for the environment, which actually has a lot of interaction with each other as well. That's sort of the genesis of the idea with me. Fast forwarding a little bit, I spent some years in consulting in mainstream private equity investing. And then around 12 years ago or so, I set out really saying, okay, impact investing, that's the thing that I want to do. The word existed by then. It was already a bit of a confusing word, and that's something maybe we come back to later. But long story short, I ended up finding FMO, the Dutch Development Bank, as you mentioned earlier. And I worked as an investment officer there for a couple of years, and then became a manager of a team that was investing into private equity funds and working on co-investments alongside them in Africa, also in Latin America, and really investing with the primary objective of supporting the private sector to achieve sustainable development, but with the market-based return objective. I did that for a little over 10 years. And then, as you mentioned, I left FMO late last year to embark on a portfolio career. So I'm serving at the moment on a couple of investment committees. I actually started work on a PhD, and I'm also doing some independent advisory work to the private capital and impact investing ecosystem. So it turns out in order to do that, I had to set up a company, and that is the genesis of Akmaso. So that's why I call myself the reluctant entrepreneur. I didn't set out to start a company, but I did set out to find out where can I use the skills and the experience that I have to continue contributing to flourishing. That's why I chose the name. I want to really help both, as you mentioned, individual people, but also teams, investors, and hopefully the broader investment community and the environment that it works in to flourish.
Well, that's great, Alice. But coming into the venture capital world from a completely different background, I'm curious, what was it that made you feel, oh, this is actually a fit?
I think what I often tell people about the world of investing is that it's a place where if you're good at math, and sorry if you're not, but if you're good at math, writing, and people skills, you actually have an opportunity to use all of those. So obviously the financial part requires some affinity with numbers, being able to ask good questions, but then distill information into logical argumentation, and to interact with people. And for me, you know, I never knew why did I study psychology, except it was interesting. But it turns out I'm interested in people and the dynamics between people, sort of contributing to well-working teams, assessing teams. So those three things coming together, I think, is for me sort of pretty high pace of pretty complicated information and trying to distill them all into some sort of sense making. That's, I think, what did it for me at the time. And of course, venture capital, Silicon Valley, 2001, was a very dynamic time and something that is very good to have lived through, because there was a lot of excitement which preceded a crash. And I think as good investors will always find the right balance between enthusiasm and knowing that what looks bright and can't fail today often does disappoint the next day.
Yeah, and it's similar for me, because I realized that the initial work that I did in political mediation and the people skills you develop managing different kinds of stakeholders, and then also realizing I was good at pattern, you know, recognition and thinking strategically. So this brings us right to the heart of our episode today. You and I are claiming that business can be a significant force for good. We're saying that it can contribute to healing where there's been brokenness in the systems that run our world. And a huge part of that is the capitalist system. We're saying that there's a place for correcting the legacies of the damaging side of business and of capitalism, of capital deployment. And we're going to touch later on the fact that colonialism, of course, has been a part of that. And that leaves a legacy that we have to be mindful of today in our work in deploying capital. But it's probably the case that many people out there think either that of business in a very neutral term, in the sense that, well, it's just a place where I go and get a job. It's a place where I make a living, make an income. That's what it's there for. It has that function, and not really looking at it for anything beyond that. Or people look at business in very negative terms, where it's like a bad virus because it just constantly seems to feed off of greed and lead to exploitation. And I know many people, including Christians, who almost live like an inner contradiction, where they don't necessarily have a negative view of business, but they have a very hard-nosed view of business. Business, the work of business is to make money, and that's its job. And if you're too soft-hearted, or if you allow your good-heartedness to get too much in the mix, then you'll start to compromise the effectiveness of business. And that's a very widespread perspective out there as well, I think. But you and I work in the investing world, and I think in that world, this thinking plays out in a similar way. I'm not sure what you think about this, Allison, but I run into the assumption that if we invest capital in businesses that are strongly focused on good social outcomes, on fixing problems or environmental problems, then we'll have to settle for below average financial performance. And often the term we use for that is concessionary capital, which is not a term I personally like. And the reason is because to concede means it's a defeatist word. And it seems to imply that I'm kind of reluctantly giving up money in return for some good social outcomes. And I think that's the wrong way to think about the function of capital as well as those outcomes. And it implies that financial outcomes are always a superior in an ideal world. So commonly there are people who think that business is necessary, but has a hard-nosed profit maximization purpose, or they think even worse, that business and the free market system behind it is bankrupt. So you and I are arguing something different to that. We're saying that these views maybe have some truth in them, but actually there are views of business that drive how business works that are faulty. And we need to rethink those driving views, those in a sense, those operating systems that are behind business. It's not that business is inherently bad. It's that we've allowed bad thinking to shape our ideas about business, and those ideas have then led to deeply distorted practices and behaviors. So as Christians, being reconciled to God and Jesus opens us to the opportunity of having our minds reconciled to God, to having how we think be brought back into line with the God who made this world and who made us. And for this to happen, there has to be a journey of digging down into the foundational building blocks of the ideas we live by, the ideas that drive what we do in the business world. And in this episode, we're looking both at the enterprise side, in other words, the operational side of starting or running a business, but also at the investing side. Allison, before I go on, I feel like I've talked a lot there. So I don't know if you want to interact with anything I've just said.
It's interesting what you said about concessionary capital, and the fact that you're conceding defeat by not maximizing your profit. There's a lot of assumptions that are in there that basically says the purpose of capital is always to maximize its financial return. And within the limits of a capitalist system, where at least we agree that someone owns capital and that the market is a way to allocate it, even in that context, we have to agree that whoever owns the capital has the liberty to determine how they wish to invest it. So indeed, concessionary capital often comes from governments who have decided, or even more philanthropically oriented investors who have decided that alongside the financial return or even a smaller financial return, they would like to ensure that other people are investing. So it's not defeat. You know, it's actually a willful, intentional decision to deploy their capital in a certain way with a lower return profile or with a higher risk profile in order to stimulate investment by others. So I think actually this mindset can be one that's very inspiring for people whose job it is to allocate capital, and especially when it's their own capital, because they can then decide what return do I want to my capital? Do I want to only maximize return, or would I like to have my capital seeking other kinds of impacts alongside it? So I think when you say sort of questioning the assumptions, what's behind the system that we're working in, this is a very good example of that.
Yes, and language is so important, the language we use. That's my own preference, is to use catalytic to describe the kinds of deployments you're talking about, because then you're not, the language of concession doesn't need to have the signaling effect that it can have, of that we're kind of giving one thing up in order to another, reluctantly giving one thing up in order to take on the other.
No, and I think, as mentioned earlier, the word impact investing can cause confusion. And this is exactly the reason, because within the meaning of impact investment, everything is included, from essentially philanthropic capital that accepts to have the capital returned if necessary, to essentially commercial capital that seeks those investment opportunities which have a market-based risk-return profile and have the impact next to it. And there's a whole spectrum across between those two, which reflects actually the level of risk, return, and impact that underlying investors are looking for. So in that sense, the word impact investing, sometimes people find off-putting because they think it means concessional. They think it means impact instead of return. But actually, it's vague enough to capture virtually any kind of risk, return, impact combination.
Thanks, Allison. That sets us up helpfully. But to help unpack this, let me start with a story from my days growing up in Papua. Now, in the region I grew up in, there's really two ways to get around, either by small aircraft or on foot. There was no roads. There was just these small airstrips that small planes flew in and out of. And the ironic thing for those who lived in the tribal communities there is that they had seen planes routinely, even though they had not had exposure to really any other kind of technology from the outside world. Which is really quite interesting, because, of course, for most people today who live in a city, they've never been in a small plane, but they've seen many other things. And it's really the reverse for the Yali people. So this story happens one day where a missionary who's in the medical field decides that she needs a Yali man to accompany her to the coast of Papua. So they get in the small plane. This is not alarming to him. He's done this before, to get from one village to another. And they fly out to town, where they get into a larger plane that has two engines, 30 seats instead of 5 seats. And then they fly out to the coast. And there they're met by some other missionaries who have brought a van to the runway. So he disembarks from the plane. He's asked to sit in the van, clips in his seatbelt, and off they drive. But after a few minutes, he's starting to look really uncomfortable. And at some point, Carol, the missionary, turns to him and says, "Engirap, are you okay? What's wrong?" And he looks at her and he says, "Carol, when are we going to take off?" So, of course, Engirap didn't know what a car was. He'd never seen one before. He just assumed he's in a plane. And this is a really good illustration of how our assumptions come into play, that we see a certain set of signals and we think, oh, it has to be this way. I've seen the chassis, I see windscreen, I see wheels. It has to be a plane, because it's the only thing he's ever seen that has those components. And I think in a similar way, in any part of our lives, but especially in the business world, we have components of a business system, and we think that these components mean, without any reason for questioning, that there's only one way to go about doing business. And actually, I think we need to interrogate those assumptions, and that there may be, and I think you, Allison, you and I believe there are, in fact, better ways to go about doing business, where it doesn't have to be extractive and it doesn't have to be damaging.
Yeah, I think your example is an interesting one, because you don't often know what your assumptions are. That's only when they're challenged that you realize that things which you've taken as truth actually might be a specific perspective or only an example of the truth. So probably a very clear example of that is the idea of stakeholder capitalism, and the idea that businesses exist for the benefit of shareholders. And the purpose of business is to maximize shareholder return. And especially anyone that's gone to a U.S. business school or has learned according to what's called the Anglo-Saxon model probably believes that, and may not have questioned that that's the purpose of business. And of course, it employs capital and it has labor and there are products, but all of those are simply tools to maximize the returns for the shareholders. Well, that's a perspective. That's a very specific example of how a company can be run. There's other ways to look at it. There's a stakeholder view that says a company operates in a place, so it contributes to paying taxes in the municipality or in the country, and it hires people, and its operations consume resources and potentially create pollution or outputs. So there are many stakeholders actually of this business that are impacted: the environment, the local community, the employees. And all of those are relevant parties to consider when thinking about the purpose of the business. And should it maximize profit to the degradation of the environment and exploiting the workers? Why? Why should that be the case? And why should it only be government regulation that constrains these sort of negative byproducts of business? Can a business itself not actually choose to operate in a way that's actually respectful, responsible, stewarding actually these relationships and the environment in which it works?
Right. No, that's excellent. This is one of the advantages for folk like you and me who came from another world into venture capital, is I got anthropological training when I was younger, and I love a worldview model where at the heart of that model are our beliefs, our assumptions about what's true, about reality. And out of those assumptions come our values, what we actually prioritize, where we place emphasis in terms of where we choose to put our time or our energy or our resources. And then out of that, of course, is behaviors and the structures and the systems that arise out of those behaviors. And one of the things I've thought about the marketplace system that you and I are in is when we think that profit maximization is at that core, that belief, this is why we exist. This is our fundamental purpose. In my experience or observation, it starts to lead to certain kinds of values. And what we value, of course, is primarily earnings. So we're missing out all those other things you just mentioned, which are actually components of the value creation process, you know, of a business. And if we value earnings, if that's where we're placing our priority, our psychic energy and our physical energy, then you start to behave extractively towards those stakeholders that you talked about, whether they're your employers, employees, or the resources from which you make your product or service. And that can become quite destructive. These are older examples, but I remember years ago looking in the telco industry and seeing how, and you don't really get this here in South Africa, but in the US and Canada, you still get this annoying feature where if you call somebody and you only get their voicemail, you get this long message that precedes their voice message. And that message is really put there to just make you spend more time on the call and adds more dollars to the bottom line of a typical TV company. And back in 2010, when I first came across this, the figure was estimated to be just one company would make an extra $600 million out of its customers for that extra bit of time that it was forcing them to spend on the phone and creating more airtime. So massive forms of extraction occur, and it actually becomes quite exploitative.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing with this example, Jonathan, is that it's very short-termist, right? So if you take the shareholder value maximization value system and say, okay, we're going to force our customers to spend whatever it is, 5 seconds per voice message of airtime every time they listen to their voicemail. In the short term, you've generated those additional profits, apparently. But as soon as a competitor comes along, I mean, you're annoying your customer every time you do that, right? They can't get around it. But as soon as there's a competitor that either stops charging by the minute, which is what collapsed that whole business model in the first place, or simply makes a more customer-friendly interface, your customer is gone. So it's very short-termist. So again, in this idea that you're always trading off responsible business versus profit maximization, it's not necessarily the case, because there's a longer term view. And sometimes I think the more responsible, more integrative business practices are the ones which may not maximize the profit in the short term, but actually contribute to building a more sustainable business over the long term.
Yeah. And that raises the question of, well, what is profit maximization anyway? You know, against what benchmark are you measuring maximal, you know, and over what time horizon? It's a completely fuzzy concept when you actually think about it, and which tends to just drive this, the worst narrative about the capitalist enterprise, which is just always trying to take more and more and more. But it doesn't have to be this way. And as always in this podcast, we start out our deconstruction efforts, our efforts to kind of interrogate our thinking by reading from the Bible. And we're going to come back now to the letter to the Colossians, which we introduced in episode one, where Paul, one of the early leaders of the Christian church, is writing to this very obscure, very small group of Christians as they would have been at that time when the church was this kind of despised and very small entity in the Roman Empire. But he still writes this magnificent letter with these magnificent ideas that speak to God's work in this world. So we're reading from three different parts of Colossians, but they're all very connected. So the first is Colossians chapter 2, verses 6 to 10, where Paul said, "As you have received Messiah Jesus the Lord, continue to live your lives in him, firmly rooted and built upon him, and established in the faith, just as you are taught, abounding in thanksgiving. See that no one captures you by way of philosophy and empty deceit that comes from human tradition, from the elemental spirits of the cosmos, and not from the Messiah. Because in him, in Jesus, resides the fullness of God, and you who have received Jesus have been filled in him, who is the head over every ruler and every authority." And later in Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 to 4, Paul goes on to say, "So if you have been raised together with Messiah, seek the things that are above, where Messiah is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on the things that are above, not on the things that are on earth, for you have died, and your life is hidden with Messiah in God. When Messiah, who is your life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with him in glory." And then finally, in Colossians 3, verses 9 to 11, Paul goes on to say, "Do not lie to one another, seeing that you have stripped off the old self with its practices and have clothed yourselves with a new self, which is being renewed in knowledge according to the image of its creator. In his image, there's no longer Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, enslaved, free, but Messiah is all and in all." So, Allison, as we listen to these words from the New Testament, of course, you and I are Christians, and much of the audience listening to this show are Christians, although not all. Now, all of us, Christian or otherwise, have the task, and it's a good task, of interrogating our thinking, of questioning our assumptions. And sometimes the best and easiest way to do that is to go to another culture and see how they think. Or if you're in a career, go to another industry and learn from that industry. But as Christians, we believe that there's a lot more going on that needs to be addressed if we're to interrogate our thinking and if our thinking is to be transformed, or to use the language of this podcast, to be reoriented to Jesus. And what we see in these verses is that the baseline condition of any human being is that without God's presence within our own lives, there's a dimension to our thinking that is hostile to him and evil in its behavior. That's what we've just read in these verses. And where Paul says, "You were once estranged and enemies in your mindsets and evil deeds." And this enemy language is needs to be unpacked a bit. It's not that we are enemies to God, that he sees us with animosity, but that our animosity is directed towards him. And his posture towards us, of course, is one of love, which explains why he then comes in the man Jesus to die on the cross and to reconcile us to himself. It means we experience a distortion of our ability to perceive and to conceive about things well, that we're never free from the deep distortions of fear, self-centeredness, or exploitativeness that are at work when we are stuck in a place of in our own brokenness. And that's what God is rescuing us from. Elsewhere in the same letter, Paul talks about God's rescue of us in Christ, in the Messiah, frees us from the power of, quote, our flesh. It's the language he uses throughout the New Testament. We've talked about this before, that by flesh, he's really talking about us living purely in our physicality without his spirit enlivening us. And God is saying we've been freed from our own brokenness. Through Jesus, we've been freed from the darkening of our mind, and we've been freed from these dark powers that can influence us and push us in harmful directions.
It's really interesting perspective to take, and the link to what you've called systemic change is that these dark powers, or what you also referred to as the flesh, is something in us, so that in Christ each of us has been set free from that. And yet we live in a world where for generation upon generation, humans have been living according to a way that's different than the way of God. So even as we as individuals may be set free and changed, we're still in an environment that's very much shaped by what you and Paul referred to as the flesh. So the non-spiritual or the non-God-oriented aspect of ourselves. And so you've referred to sort of the spiritual component of that, which may be more relatable for some listeners. And even the ones that are not looking at the world from that perspective will see it in this whole discussion we've had earlier about the capitalist system. There's also the whole structure of society in which we live and the economies in which we live is shaped by a non-God-centric worldview, even though we see some of the Judeo-Christian values still reflected in our legislation and in social welfare systems in some countries. The intention that capitalism should surely and purely be about serving money is part of that distinct from God-centric worldview and the system that we can consider how we may engage with it and seek to change it.
Yeah. And for those of our listeners who don't believe in things like dark powers, I think nobody can deny that whether it's from the supernatural realm or not, these systems that we're talking about, they take on a power of their own. And they seem to have this momentum and energy and force behind them, which is part of what we're up against. But Jesus said the truth sets us free. And elsewhere in the New Testament, Paul says that we need to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And so that's really what we're here to do is, I mean, Allison, you and I, we know it's a lifelong journey. It's not like you and I have it all figured out. But what we're trying to do is take upon ourselves this task of being clear-eyed about the assumptions that drive the systems that we operate in so that we can more thoroughly or more comprehensively see transformation in those systems that is healing and whole.
If you've been enjoying the conversation so far, please review this episode to help shape future content on Reframed.
So let's come back to what we've been talking about, which is the world of business and the world of capital. And let's start first focusing on the operating systems that underlie business. Is business, Allison, grubby? Is it dirty? Does it actually have a role to play? Help us with that question.
I guess I hope not. And I suspect you feel the same, because otherwise we're sort of dirtying ourselves by working in a company or in a business related setting. So no, I don't think that business is automatically dirty or grubby, but I think we do have to acknowledge, as you've said earlier, that capitalism unchecked can easily devolve into exploitation of labor, reckless using up of natural resources, polluting the environment, other unethical business practices. So I think, you know, if we start from business, what's it about? It's about making money. Maybe it's about producing goods and services in an organized way. Is there anything intrinsically wrong with it? No. I mean, we're productive people. We've been created to produce things. Even if you just look at agriculture, there's a certain amount of work that goes in and there's food that comes out. You know, we decided we need clothing. So some people specialized in the making of garments, others in the building of homes. So at a certain point, money evolved to sort of exchange goods and services across distance, across time. It's a tool. And I think what Jesus said about money is that it's the love of money that's the root of all evil, not money itself. And when we focus too much of our attention and our longing on money instead of the things that it's intended for, just a means of commerce, that's when it can go wrong. And where's the opportunity? Of course, business as a way to give people meaningful work, dignity, the ability to feed their families, to create good products and services, to interact responsibly with the world around us and with each other. I think in this way, business can be seen as an outworking of stewardship and of love.
Yeah, I had this epiphany when I first was working in South Africa years ago when I was in the NGO world, not in the business world, that the marketplace is where the average person is trying to make life work. And it's the dominant place in society where we're trying to make life work. Government has its role, but it's really a role that there are goods and services that come from government, but there's a role of, in a sense, setting up the playing field. And the marketplace is the playing field where we make life work. So it's very important. It's very significant. Now, we talked about assumptions earlier. Two of the key assumptions that I think have underpinned how we practice business today come from the key thinkers in the past. The first being Adam Smith in his book, Wealth of Nations, which he wrote at the same time that Alison, your country achieved its independence from the tyranny of Great Britain, was when he wrote, "I've never known much good done by those who affected to trade, in other words, to do business for the public good. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest." So basically, he's saying when business people do business out of their own self-interest, then that's what makes business work. It's that self-interest that is a key driver to business. And then more recently, in the 1970s, Milton Friedman, an economist, wrote a very well-known essay that really became, I would say, quite fundamental to how businesses thought and operated for many years, where he said that the social responsibility of business is to increase its profits. Now, we've already questioned that. And I think it's good now to go back to that worldview model that I spoke to earlier, where you have your belief systems, your assumptions at the center, and then you move out from that to what you think is important, what you value, and out from that to your actions and your behaviors. And when I use a model like that, I look at that core assumption that we exist to maximize profit. And it, to me, it begs the question, well, where does profitability come from in the first place? It comes from value creation. And value creation at its maximum or at its optimum is what happens when the business pays closest attention to its customer. So it actually requires, you know, Adam Smith said it requires a self-centeredness to drive business. But I would actually argue that a key dimension of business is an other-centeredness. In business, we say we're customer-centric. It's good for a business to be customer-centric. So right there, you have a piece of data that starts to maybe unravel that thread of that idea that we exist just for profit maximization. So we create value by serving our customers well. And out of the efficiencies with which we run our business, we can be profitable. And again, efficiency doesn't have to mean being extractive and damaging as we operate our business. And again, it raises the question of, well, how robust is our accounting? You know, because are we able to account for the externalities of our business operation and the potentially the damage that we're doing, including financial damage, by extracting and being unsustainable in our business operation? So being efficient is not the same as being extractive. So if you have a value creation mindset, that's a service mindset. And a company, you and I, Alison, know that the best companies are the ones that treat their employees well. You know, the leaders have a mindset of service towards their employees. Those employees tend to thrive in an environment like that. And employees who are treated well also treat the customer well. And, you know, it's a bit of a virtuous circle there. So I think this is another way where we can use that worldview framework to interrogate these assumptions and start to challenge them and to question them.
Yes, I think the idea that business is for value creation and for profit can so easily be reduced to this share price maximization, which is a reductionist view, even of profit, as you've mentioned. So you can create a profitable business by treating your employees well, who then treat your customers well, and reducing your entire purpose to one number is simply not consistent with the reality that we live in. So even as you've said, there might be other things you should account for besides your financial profits. There are companies where the share price is more or less reflective of the actual sustainable value of the company. And reducing any incentive or target to a single number is bound to create unintended consequences where people will manipulate or otherwise create the outcome that's looked for by compromising or even defrauding their investors, shareholders, employees, etc., just to come up with that one desired outcome. So I think even in a purely for-profit business environment, it's very dangerous to reduce targets to a single number. I remember a situation where salespeople were given a target of maximizing sales, and they did, but you know, no one thought about the fact that the customer may or may not pay, or if your sales are in very small volumes and therefore you have very high costs to deliver each individual package, you know, the sales might be not profitable enough, or the sales might never translate into actual cash receipts. And neither of those is okay, right? So even if you say, look, we're just going to incentivize salespeople to sell, you have to look at that in a holistic way to get the results you want for your business. And even more so when you're incentivizing your senior management for share price alone, you're going to get all manner of unintended consequences.
And we saw that in a big way back in 2008 when the financial crash occurred, which is really, it was an outworking of people trying to game the profit-making system in the financial services industry in as clever a way, quote unquote, clever a way as possible, without realizing there was all these other dynamics going on. And the result of all that cleverness was an incredible amount of value destruction. And I've got some stats here that were issued by The Economist 6 years after that crash, where they said that America economically had regressed 10 years as a result of that financial crash and the behaviors that drove it, that the UK had regressed 8, Greece had regressed 12 years, but the actual Greek stocks were wiped out about 20 years back. So it was a total destruction of value, you know, just purely on financial terms, let alone what you saw happen in the US, for example, in terms of livelihoods.
So I guess those are some of the downsides of too much focus on profit or shareholder return. But I think you also alluded to the fact that profit can be good. And in the best case, a profitable investment yields additional capital to invest again. And so if we take sort of more the agricultural approach or view towards investing, you know, a good farmer will retain a portion of the seed from the harvest in order to sow again the next year. And in the best of all possible worlds, profits is something which allows new investment, whether it's in the same company to expand and to bring the products or services into new markets, or whether it's from the entrepreneur or the shareholder to invest in new businesses. So I think taking that view on profits as, okay, what are you going to do with that capital once you've sort of grown it, and seeing the increase of wealth not only as a way to make oneself or one's family comfortable or to sort of guarantee one's own future, but say, okay, where can this capital be reinvested to see more growth, more provision of goods and services and jobs, is sort of a more, I would say, more kingdom-oriented way to look at profits as well. For what purpose is the profit actually? And what are you going to do with them when they come in?
Yeah, Alison, and what we're really talking about is what happens, how you can rethink all these different components of the capitalist system when you're operating from a place of love. You know, love for the other, which is really at the heart of a Jesus-centered life. And before we get to where you're ending there about how we invest and what lies behind what kind of agenda we invest with, I want to come back to a couple other aspects of the marketplace that, again, we've described ways that they've been used very detrimentally, but I think can have very powerful effects. And one that I think is very important is that the marketplace has accountability systems built into, or accountability mechanisms built into it. You know, if you don't deliver a product or a service that is genuinely valued by the customer is not going to buy it. So you're forced to offer good value. Now, of course, customers can be tricked, but at its best, that is how business works. The not-for-profit world doesn't have that accountability mechanism because we've split the buyer, who is in the not-for-profit world, a donor, from the beneficiary. Whereas in the for-profit world, the beneficiary can actually exercise that accountability mechanism. I think that's one area of accountability that's key. And the other is that in order to be profitable, in order to have sustainability in your business, you have to build and deliver your products and services with efficiency. And so, yes, that can be very extractive and damaging if it's done in an unhealthy way. It doesn't have to be done in an unhealthy way. And there are ways to be efficient that are a reflection, basically, of what you said earlier is good stewardship. And of course, there's so much in our world that reflects poor stewardship. It reflects our greed. It reflects our unchecked consumption. But that doesn't mean business has to operate that way. And so we're talking about what happens when service, when a commitment to the other and to the created world that we're a part of informs these basic mechanisms of business, which can actually be very good and very effective in delivering services and goods to customers that have been tested and proven. So Alison, returning to what you were talking about last, which is how we invest our capital, how we deploy it, let's look at that in the context of Africa, where you and I are both focused, where there has been a lot of not-for-profit activity historically and a lot of aid and development work, and that is how capital has been deployed. And in a sense, I think what you and I are arguing is that part of the problem of that, it has run foul of some of the problems that we've talked about earlier, where the beneficiary and the buyer are not the same person. And it could be argued that a more impactful way to deploy capital in the African context for the kinds of outcomes that we've all been wanting to see happen here is to do it through business.
No, I think that we've discussed before that there's certainly a role for aid and donor charity type of interventions in the world where there's a crisis or where there's genuinely a situation where people are in need and cannot reasonably help themselves. But there's also been a lot of research done about the detrimental effects of long-term aid as a method and as an instrument, especially in the emerging economies context. And so I think that was what sort of inspired me about the world of development finance in the first place and impact investing more broadly, is to say, rather than sort of giving money away, which lacks the accountability, as you've mentioned, but also puts two people in a relationship of there's a hierarchy or a dependency, which is, I would say, not healthy in the longer term. Puts people into a relationship of partnership. One brings the company and one brings the capital, for example. And so it's an opportunity to engage on a much more respectful peer basis with other humans and to find ways to enable flourishing in the world. There are so many entrepreneurs, investment firms, companies that are active in Africa and in emerging markets more generally. And if you have an opportunity to bring capital to enable growth, whether it's investing in further production facilities or growing the team, there's, for me, that was a fantastic way to bring the skills and the toolkit of investing to bear in a place where you could really see that you're contributing to building local economies. And if you invest in a company, assuming it's profitable, and that's sort of the base case, then it's continues to operate. So you haven't fed a family once, you've provided employment, and that's something that's much more sustainable and enduring. And if the company grows, it will continue to employ more people. And if it's expanding into new markets, or if it's growing its headquarters staff, it'll provide career opportunities for people. So you often think about jobs in terms of sort of daily wages, but a growing company also provides potential for people to grow within a company and to be trained and to grow in their careers, as we discussed earlier. So there's much broader impact and more lasting impact, actually, of those monies going into a company versus being spent on aid, which typically is something that's consumed and then is gone.
What do people come to you for? What do they come to Akmazo for?
I mean, I think the opportunity, which continues to emerge slowly, is for more people can be institutions or actual individuals, but more capital, either asset owners, capital allocators, to catch a vision for investments where the return profile is at least uncertain. And you mentioned earlier, like, is there a trade-off? Do we naturally or automatically expect that the risk return profile is less attractive for Africa? The past performance suggests that it is, but it's different in any case. There's much less leverage. There's other exposures like macro and like currency changes that investors do take. But is there an opportunity for asset owners and capital allocators to say, I want to steer capital there into emerging markets, into impact investment opportunities where I do expect to get a financial return? I cannot predict exactly what it's going to be because there's less of a track record, or because the track record is a bit less compelling financially than others, but where I believe that capital is going to have an impact. It's going to contribute to changing the world that we live in for the better. It's going to contribute to preserving the environment, to preserving job opportunities and the ability to do business in areas that are affected by climate change, to creating employment, to bringing better quality goods and services to people who wouldn't otherwise have access to them. So that's, say, what is the driving principle behind ACMAZO is actually, this is still coming. It's coming a bit more slowly than I expected, because 12 years ago when I joined FMO, we were at the crest of a wave of more people allocating to investments in Africa, which has tapered off. But I think it should still, and I think more people should be made aware of those investment opportunities. And more people should work to build companies that are creating both a return and acting responsibly as citizens in their local environments, that are employing people and are creating good quality products and services with respect for the environment. So that's where I would like to play a part. And that's where I think some of our listeners, whether they're entrepreneurs, whether they're investors, whether they have their own money to invest or they're allocating other people's money, these are the things that they should be thinking about. Do I have to adhere to this shareholder value first worldview, or is there an opportunity for me to look broader and to allocate my time, my skills, whether that's building a business or allocating investing money and the money that I have stewardship over, to meet actually all three of these objectives in the world: financial, environmental, and social.
And Allison, in your work, where are you seeing people who have this mindset and who are deploying capital in this way in Africa? Where are they focusing that capital? What kinds of problem solving are they trying to do specifically? Which areas?
I think the interesting thing with impact investing is that problem solving is opportunity seeking, right? So problem solving always has a bit of a negative ring to me, because it brings me back to that aid and the sort of negative mindset. Although, of course, there are problems to be solved, but an investor always looks at a problem as an opportunity. I think the one that's attracted a lot of capital and volume is renewable energy, especially as you see sort of growing economies and growing industry that requires electric power. And if that can be provided through renewable sources, that's really interesting, both from a financial perspective and from an impact perspective. I think there's a lot of attention now for agribusiness, although this is not always a very high returning investment opportunity, certainly one where people can be employed and where food can be supplied. So obviously meeting essential needs of people and using some new technologies or proven technologies, but that might be new in certain areas to increase the productiveness of agriculture. But you also see it in financial services, also in pharmaceuticals, production and distribution. Also in everything in the food value chain, actually, so sort of processing, packaging, food, and grocery retail, and some things that with a Western mindset we might think are just normal or neutral business opportunities. When you bring them to a place where they're not there, I still consider that to have impact. So I think for a person with capital, allocating capital to impact investing, the first question they must ask themselves is, what kind of impacts do I want? And do I indeed want to be that catalytic capital that takes a very high risk but with the potential to bring others along if the venture is successful. There are probably relatively fewer opportunities to invest in mature companies or assets. But for example, you could invest in an existing portfolio of operating renewable energy assets, which would have a materially lower risk and probably quite a smaller, quite a bit smaller return as well.
Thanks, Alison. And I do think as well, one of the challenges that we face in Africa, there are obviously very real headwinds. There's social headwinds, political headwinds, and so on. There's legacy headwinds in the sense of lack of infrastructure. But at the same time, it's a continent that has the youngest population in the world. It will be the labor pool of the future. It's important that that not be exploited, but it is a place of opportunity. It's also, as you and I well know, it is not a country. It's a vast, vast, vast continent. And one of the things I sometimes find a little bit concerning when you talk to investors, especially from further away like North America, who interested in Africa, but maybe you know they're intimidated or concerned by the risk profile of the continent, but not realizing that this vastness is a feature of the continent. There are very stable parts of the continent. There's parts of the continent where there are tremendous amounts of opportunity. And if you understand the market and you know the local market, you can work in that local market. Just in the same way, if you're an investor from Seattle and you've lived and worked in Seattle all your life, and now you're looking at doing something in Pensacola in Florida, you're going to take a bit of time to work, understand how that market works because it's a different geography. And I do think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity in this continent. And also it's important that we not lump an entire continent into a risk profile, but rather that we are more nuanced and specific about what is required in each location. But talking about risk, this is, in a sense, my call to listeners who are Christians and who are investors or may one day be investors, is just like an encouragement to consider the role that Christians can play, who maybe don't have to put as much weight on looking after ourselves in how we deploy our capital, to be more risk-oriented, not risk-oriented in the sense of not evaluating or calculating the risk, but taking calculated risks because you see the possibility of a particular innovation arising out of that or a particular transformation in some part of our world. And that is, as you touched on earlier, that's distinguishing between whether I view my capital as a type of seed or whether I'm wanting my capital to bring me back bread. In other words, I want it to generate or I want it to look after me. So there's this idea of relinquishment, of release of what he's given to us, but not just releasing mindlessly, but releasing in a way that stewards that capital for the kinds of outcomes that you and I are talking about, as a means of being a reconciliatory force in our world, as opposed to simply trying to make a return.
So it's interesting because Jesus actually refers a lot to investing in the parables that he tells. And the one that came to mind now is the one where a man leaves three of his servants, one with five talents, one with two, and one with one. And the first two both invest and double their money, and the third guy puts it in the ground. And when the master comes back, the other two are praised and this guy is chastised for putting it in the ground. And he said, like, you should have at least put it in the bank and given me my interest. And I often wonder what would have happened if the guy had invested it and lost it, because it was probably a very risk averse guy. But, you know, the master actually already pre-answers that question by saying, well, if you're a very risk averse guy, I can also still accept you, but then at least put it in the bank. So I think your sort of encouragement to people to consider letting go of what property you have that you genuinely believe is yours. I think God is gracious and he understands that we have different and evolving risk appetites. So it doesn't mean that everyone must promptly put all their money in a very high risk venture after hearing this podcast. But I hope that they will be challenged to think, am I taking enough risk or can I take a bit more? And if part of that risk is allocating part of my portfolio to something where I think it's going to have a positive impact next to a return, and maybe I'm less sure about the return, you know, every step in the right direction is still a step in faith, and I think will be rewarded, and maybe has even the impact that we intend.
Yeah, That's very good. It is about that underlying drive. What's actually leading us to make the decisions that we make? Yeah, the risk profile might be different for each investor, but what heart are they coming with? What's the work that they want to put their money to? Of course, when you're talking about investing in Africa, you run up against the legacy of colonialism and the history of extractive behaviors, especially coming from the West, but also from the global East. And those do need to be corrected. And I'm aware of a Christian network. It's called the Angelo Network. And within that network, they have developed an amazing manifesto for investors operating in frontier markets, including in the African context, to work against these exploitative patterns that have historically characterized investing, called the Nairobi Declaration. And it includes the following words: "Together we declare that effective Christian impact investing in frontier markets will work through mutual submission and towards equal partnership in power, value, and respect between investors and frontier market operators. We reject the perversion and abuse of power within our own societies, whether it be on the basis of tribe, race, creed, gender, or wealth. We invite investors to a journey of mutual submission and transformation as we unite as the functioning body of Christ across cultures to solve problems." And maybe we should add there, Allison, "and to pursue opportunity."
I like that. And what I really like about this is it challenges the assumption that, again, so easily sort of creeps into our way of working, that capital is power and that the one who has the money calls the shots. And this comes back a bit to what I said earlier about partnering with people as peers, which is hard in the system, again, which says the one who comes with the money can tell the others what to do. So I actually love this perspective and the word mutual submission that says we're gonna go into this together, each bringing what he or she or they have to offer in partnership with mutual respect. I love that.
Yeah. Well, we have covered a lot of ground today, Allison, and I'm really grateful for the conversation we've had. I think to circle back to the beginning and to particularly to the biblical text that we referred to earlier, this freedom that when we've come to Jesus and received him, this freedom that we receive is a freedom that frees our minds, frees our imagination to think differently. Now, it's not as if somebody who's not a Christian can't do that, but they can, and we can do it together. But what is important is this idea that God is available to us to be with us in that rethinking. We can have his Spirit inspiring us, and we can have the Word of God, the Bible inspiring us. We've got the wisdom of the church throughout the ages and across different cultures today to also inspire us, to help us think differently.
I think in the passage that we heard from Colossians, that the phrase appeared, "set your minds on things above." And for me, that's the thing that will stick with me from this conversation, that we're in a world which has a certain system, that we've been set free from it. But as we sort of continue our own journey of transformation, and as we're trying to engage in a process of transformation with the systems around us, it's by setting our mind on the thing above. In other words, as you mentioned, Jesus and the work that he's done for us, God and his love for us, that's what actually makes it possible to continue on this journey in the face of a rather challenging environment and non-obvious change that we hope to see in the world.
Well, Allison, thank you for joining us in this episode. It was lovely to have you, and so appreciate your spirit. And of course, in a broad sense, you and I are colleagues, so we'll see each other in the workplace somewhere, somehow.
I look forward to that. Thank you for having me.
So friends, if you're enjoying this podcast or others at Ziwani, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast platform. And be sure to come back in 2 weeks for the next episode, which is actually with Andy Crouch, who introduced Allison and I to each other. And Andy and I will be working through the topic, Big Change in Our Minds, Introducing Christ-Centered Behaviors in Business. Until then, this is goodbye from me, Jonathan Wilson.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.